Thank you for joining us for this very special episode of Movie Geeks United. Tonight, we explore the films of Alfred Hitchcock with one of our favorite guests, esteemed film critic Tony Macklin. You can read Mr. Macklin's film reviews, as well as his interviews with some of the most legendary film directors to ever grace the art form, including Mr. Hitchcock, at his website at tonymacklin.net. You hear a lot now, particularly for those that work in the thriller genre, that they're going for a kind of Hitchcockian vibe. When you hear that term Hitchcockian, what kind of qualities does that signify to you?
I think that's the wrong approach. They think Hitchcock is the ultimate thriller suspense director, but he's much more. His themes are actually much more valuable than just his style. Initially, he was considered a technician, very technically adept, very deft and very canny, but very superficial. There was nothing beneath the surface. It was just escapist entertainment. And then, about, say, the middle 50s, the French André Bazine and especially Truffaut, François Truffaut, came out with this theory about auteurism, the auteur being the French word for author. And they looked at the work of people, of men and women, but filmmakers like Hitchcock, and found out that he wasn't just this escapist entertainment fun guy, but there was a real personal vision to his work. And I think that is the thing that has so intrigued me, that it's almost like as criticism grew, the films grew, the sense that these men were not just plumbers proficiently going to work and creating facile works, but there was a depth to their work. And when I go back and see all these Hitchcock films, they are inexhaustible. There is level after level after level. I'll give you an example of his last film, which I was fortunate enough to be on the set of, The Family Plot. In The Family Plot, Hitchcock is using some references to his past. One of the streets that the car parks on is Bates Avenue. Well, Bates Avenue is a reference to Norman Bates in Psycho. There's also somebody that says, well, you shouldn't light a light in Family Plot when in a gas station. Well, that is a reference to what happened in The Birds. And there's a car that comes down a hill in careening and out of control. And that is a reference to both, I think, North by Northwest and also Frenzy. Now, the one that really struck me, and I haven't seen anybody make this point, that in the film The Family Plot, the kidnappers want a 53-carat diamond. That's what they want for payment to release the bishop whom they have kidnapped. Well, it is, of course, The Family Plot is Hitchcock's 53rd film. So there's all those references. Also, one thing more. Sometimes fate intervenes and makes you say, wow. He died in 1980. Alma, his wife, who was 1 year younger than him, died in 82. They were married for guess how many years? 53 years.
Wow.
So it's inexhaustible. It really, you get exhilarated, and it's a constant unraveling of the themes. So I would say that, yes, they're talking about the thriller and the suspense, but it's much more. It's the themes of Hitchcock. Hitchcock has the themes of alienation and irony and the wrong man accused, the fear of the police, and all of those. I just saw a film called Arbitrage. Now, it's not a great film, but it would not have been made if there hadn't been Hitchcock, that you can see so many things that are at least responses to Hitchcock's work. The director went to NYU and obviously was a film student. And you see that time after time after time, year after year, I see films that would not have been made if Hitchcock hadn't come first. Hitchcock was the harbinger of so many of these films, and probably, or maybe perhaps, I think maybe the most important filmmaker of all time.
Well, I think I would definitely agree with you, because I don't think you could find many filmmakers that do not consider themselves influenced by Hitchcock. And, I mean, he's also one of maybe less than a handful of directors that are internationally known to themselves. I mean, I can only think of Hitchcock and Spielberg. That those two are kind of household names for people that don't even necessarily follow movies.
Well, that's a very interesting point, because Hitchcock was like Hemingway in literature, that the image of the man, Papa, in literature was in a sense very important to the promotion of his work. That Hitchcock's film, Hitchcock, the figure, oh, we're going to go to see a Hitchcock film. In the 50s and early 60s, you would read reviews that wouldn't even mention who the director was. Very few people really had any sense how much film was a director's medium. During the 50s, they thought it was actors and maybe a writer, and maybe there was somebody who put these things together. But there really was very, very little awareness of the awareness of the director. And the other thing is that film in the 50s had not yet been recognized as a potential art form, as an art form. They thought it was escapist. They thought it couldn't be art. It didn't have levels. It was image and immediacy, reaction, responses. But it didn't have something that you went back to. Andrew Sarris brought this French theory of the auteur to American criticism. And in 1960, his review of Hitchcock's Psycho was very, very seminal, very, very crucial, fundamental. He said, you have to go and see this film, not just once, but three times.
What are the comparisons that you see with Hitchcock and Kubrick?
One interesting fact is that Hitchcock was born in 1899, the last year of the 19th century, and Kubrick died in 1999, the last year of the 20th century. They both had the two of them span the century. There is also very much a similarity in vision, although people may not recognize it. Both are very, very pessimistic. Both are critical of the significance of mankind. They don't think that man is significant. Both are fatalists. They believe strongly in irony, and you can see that in work out. And they also are considered stylists more than visionaries. A lot of the reaction to them from critics and the viewership in general is that these are, quote, stylists, unquote. That's only one third of it. They are both beautiful filmmakers. They both make extraordinary films with beautiful imagery and compelling, indelible images, shots. But they also have this sense of irony, prevailing irony. It floods through both of their works. this sense that fate is, that man is dependent on fate, and this sense of alienated man and woman, the alienated person caught, trapped in the human condition, is striving, but fate is going to decree what happens to them. And in fact, I think that Kubrick very much could have made Frenzy, the film in 1972, that was one of Hitchcock's last films. That there's a sense of loss, there's a sense of waste, there's a sense of lack of communication, and that we have, our better day has passed and our values have been corrupted.
I dare say you are wondering why I am floating around London like this. I am on the famous Thames River, investigating a murder. Rivers can be very sinister places, and in my new film, Frenzy, this river, you may say, was the scene of a very horrible murder.
Frenzy opens with a shot of the Thames, and it is now dirty. The Thames is no longer the blue that it once was, and they find the body of somebody with a necktie. And somebody says, "Is that the old? That's my old club tie. My club tie." And I think Hitchcock is suggesting that the old standards are gone, and that we now live in a kind of a wasteland. We can see that also in Kubrick. So I also love the fact that the surface of both of their works belies what is beneath it.
I want to get back to one point that you just made, and as it applies to both Hitchcock and Kubrick, their films do speak to kind of the insignificance of man in terms of their placement in the cog in the wheel of, you know, this big machine here. But in light of that, where do you find the humanism in their work?
Because they don't hate humanity. They think we're in all of this together, that some better than others. But they also both believe in creativity. And if you are creative in a world you never made or people never made, that is something. I mean, you can look at all the politics, you can look at all the advertising, you can look at all of the propaganda, and there's something about the beauty and force and wonder of vision and going ahead and trying and creativity. And I think both men are creative. The other thing I want to add, if people think, no, Hitchcock's not that pessimistic, one of the most pessimistic, maybe the most pessimistic film up to its release in 1958 that ever was made in America, in a popular film, is Hitchcock's Vertigo. I mean, it ends in abject loss when his second chance plummets, and it's the nun that this girl, Judy, who is now become Madeline, she falls off the tower for, I quote, second time, and this time to her death. This time it is the real woman that he loved. And Jimmy Stewart stands with his hands forward. And when I taught it in class, the student said, "We thought he was going to jump. Now, wait a minute. He's not going to jump. He's going to live with the horror and loss and frustration and pessimism of futility."
Yeah.
And what Hitchcock does so well, and a lot of his films have the life of humor in them. I was talking to you about Frenzy, which I think is really an underrated Hitchcockian film. There is an inspector and his wife, and they are a riot. She is cooking. She is taking up gourmet cooking, and she's cooking dinners for him, and they're awful. I mean, they're just wretched. And the incongruity and the absurdity, and Hitchcock's funny bone is just tingling. It's just vibrant. And that shows part of his creativity. Just because, I mean, all of us know someday we're not going to be around anymore. Well, that doesn't mean we don't strive for the next day. Some people turn to religion. A few turn to art. And I think that both of these men have been able to face the world around them and say, I believe my God is creativity. Now, Hitchcock was also a Catholic. He was also a Jesuit trained, and it seems like he went to Mass up till his death. And in fact, Catholic church had a Mass for him after his death in California. I think it's the humanity. I think Jonathan Swift also said, I don't like mankind, but I like three individuals. I think these are the same kind of men that they find in the spirit of the creative, the spirit of the realist, the spirit of the man who thinks and perceives and tries to understand. They see a value that transcends, in a sense, all of the failure and all of the rubbish and all of the carnage that is around them.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I do think that just the act of the creative process is in and of itself kind of a sign of a hopeful sign and wanting to discover some new layer in humankind.
Well, as a human being, as a critic, they educate me to see things that I wouldn't perceive otherwise, and to have a faith and an appreciation and get some exhilaration out of their creativity, out of their headlong plunge into the future.
Yeah.
I've learned so much from artists more than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question that writers, especially writers, whether it be Scott Fitzgerald, who was my favorite growing up, or James A.G., who was a great fiction writer as well as a great film critic, and filmmakers, Peckinpah, Altman, Scorsese, Ford, Orson Welles, they're irreplaceable. They are the jewels in the toilet of life.
Do you think? I mean, this is a complaint that I've heard, but I have a hard time making sense of this complaint. I don't know if there's anything in here to really substantiate it. But I mean, Hitchcock was a man that you felt absolutely had the movie in his head to the letter. And once he kind of finished the pre-production phase, the movie was already made for him. It was just a question of going out and shooting it. Now, that stands in stark contrast to someone like a Robert Altman, who kind of you could feel the journey of exploration of surprising moments popping up actually while he was shooting, the movie kind of defining itself during the shoot. Do you think
there would also be more messiness in Robert Altman. I'm not a great believer in ad-libbing or that kind. Usually it's very self-absorbed. It's very self-indulgent. It rings false. But I think that they both reach their destination in different ways. But Hitchcock was not, I mean, it wasn't just, he didn't suddenly become a pure technician. He had to say, oh, that actor brought something to my film that I didn't expect. I'm going to change this shot or shoot it again. This idea that he said actors are cattle, and he's repeated, he's corrected that 1,000 times. He said, I didn't say actors were cattle. I said they should be treated like cattle. And the difference was that he meant they should be led, they should be guided, they should be shown the way, but they aren't bestial, or they aren't just beasts of burden. Now, he was a perfectionist. He also was a very, very good businessman, marketer. And so he would bring the film in under budget instead of over budget. Peckinpah's film, every film went over budget. Many of Altman's films went over budget. Hitchcock made Psycho for $800,000. And he knew what he was doing, but it doesn't mean that there's not some life in it. He did storyboard before shooting, but it meant it didn't mean that the thing was completely done. It was alive, like I think a personal relationship is alive. You know the other person. You know 80% of them, or 90% of her, or whatever, but it doesn't mean that you know everything and that you will be surprised. Bruce Dern said in shooting Frenzy, you just have to, you'll ask for reshots, but you better just, you've got to be very careful and pick three that you're going to do, and he will allow you. And why would there be a reshot? Because the actor thought that he could do something different. Or that Hitchcock would talk to somebody in another situation and say, why don't you do this a little more? And so it's not dead and buried before it's made. There is so much ignorance, or so much jumping to conclusions that simply is not valid about someone like Hitchcock. It's easy to say, well, he thinks actors are cattle, and every film is made, and there's no life, so it's just like plumbing. That's not true. If you understand art and the act of creativity, you know that he is not just going and making a stillborn film. Mm-hmm. The film has life. The film, there's something. When you watch it, you watch those scenes between McCallan, the inspector, and Vivian Merchant, his wife, and they're wonderful. I mean, there's just and I'm sure some of them were redone, because maybe a little iota, maybe a little nuance was added, or a little change, move the camera a little tiny bit, or had a different idea. He didn't go to the set as a corpse. He went to the set as a creative individual that had certainly envisioned everything, but was willing to allow it to have some percolation, to somehow simmer. And so I think that is just an easy reaction to say that, no, he just shot the film the way it was on his boards, and there's no creativity in it, blah, blah, blah. That's just nonsense.
I agree with you. But even in terms of his visual scheme, I mean, there's such an alertness there. I mean, his movies are so vivid. So vibrant.
Well, the alertness is what makes his films still vibrant today.
Yeah,
that it's an alertness. It's not a dated alertness. It's an alertness and a vivacity that comes from human nature. Comes from our human being, our human qualities. And so when you say that, alertness is a great word for that, because you can go and see any of, or most of his, maybe not Topaz and a few others, but most of his films, and they don't. They live. They're still alive. And you've seen something this time, or you're aware of something that you weren't aware of before, or you suddenly realize that you found out that Hitchcock is very interested in making religious allegories. So when he has a character named Eve, that alerts you to something. And when the villain in that film is made, is named Van Damme, and there's a snake, and there's a garden, it becomes a religious allegory on one level. It doesn't mean it is a religious film, but it is on one level. On another level, it's satire. It's satire of religions. It's satire of institutions. It's satire of the inability of the nuns and the priest to save the girl. They can only run up to the dead body. There's nothing there. Or in Family Plot, kicking over the gravestone and saying, fake, fake. I mean, there's so much. I think the fact that we are delayed on our recognition of what works in Hitchcock just means that there's more to plumb, there's more to fathom. It really is inexhaustible. And yet, the thing, the first question you asked me, the idea of suspense and thriller is something that made him marketable, but then he could be, and he could give 9 out of 10 people in the audience that, and they'd be satisfied with that. But there was another tenth, or another 1 in 10, or 1 in 20, that went back and said, oh my goodness, look what the eyes of the farmer in the birds, they've been plucked out, just like the eyes of the mother in Psycho. Oh, the two poodles that Hitchcock is coming out of the pet store, there's a pair. Let me look for pairs this time. Oh my goodness, there are pairs galore. And they aren't accidental. They aren't arbitrary. There's a real intelligence at work. And maybe it's just because the audience does not expect it to be intelligent, maybe not even want intelligence. But it's there for you, Jamie, and I know that you respond to it.
I love that. I love that. I mean, I love the kind of the subversive details that reveal themselves to you the more you watch a film, like peeling layers of an onion. I love, and that's the one of the main things I love about Kubrick, too. And that's the very definition of a movie that lives, a movie that gives that to you.
And you may be in two different moods or two different ages, and you see Vertigo as a young man, and you see the romantic qualities of it, but you see it older, and you realize that life does have its traps and its disasters and its unexpected horrors, and the film is different for you, or maybe, and I when you go to that film, Madeline, the name Madeline means the Tower of Strength. Well, she falls from the tower. The tower is the major or one of the major symbols in the film. If you've seen a Hitchcock film and you react to the hands reaching out, to the hands trying to make contact, you see it in almost every one of his films. If you're looking for it, if you're not looking for it, you don't see it.
I don't want to die. There's someone inside me. She says I must die. You don't let me go.
A beautiful girl haunted by the desperate, unexplainable urge to destroy herself. A man possessed by the paralyzing vertigo that made him afraid of high places.
Easy now.
I know. It's a cinch. Yeah, I look up. I look down. I look up. I look.
And one thing that Hitchcock does that I think the director of Arbitrage did and other directors that have come down the path is the manipulation of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Hitchcock may have been the first, and he certainly is the best, at getting us to empathize with the villain.
I want to talk about performance in his films, because to my knowledge, there was only one actor that he felt that he could not get anything out of, and that was Charles Laughton. I think they did the Jamaica Inn. I think that was the name of the film. But other than that, I think largely a number of his actors.
No, there've been. Roy Thinnes was the villain in Family Plot, and he was replaced by William Devane, and it was a great replacement because Devane's voice is much more sonorous, and there's a mellifluous evil quality to it. Many times, he also, like Kubrick, here's another thing that they have in common. He casts an actor, knowing that he's going to use that actor's emotions or lack of emotions, and that people work on the screen differently than they work in person. There's a story that after they shot Vertigo with the exquisite, just anybody that has a beating heart was infatuated with Kim Novak.
Mm-hmm.
But she wasn't a great actor. She was wooden. She was kind of wooden or glass. But he got out of her the image because of the lighting and the qualities. Well, Bernard Herrmann, who did the great, great soundtrack for Psycho in 1960, and guess what won the sound award for the 1960? The Alamo. Doesn't that say it all? I mean, that's
it. Yeah, we talk about that movie all the time, The Alamo.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially the sound. The Texans hooting at the attacking Mexicans. Oh, jeez. But Bernard Herrmann wanted to date Kim Novak and asked Hitch to kind of set it up, and he went out with Kim Novak and said it was the worst date maybe he had ever gone on, because she had no personality. She had, or at least there was no talk about electricity. There was no nothing between the two of them. But Kim Novak on the screen was this intriguing, enhanced beauty, just beyond mere mortality. And I think Hitch and Kubrick are very similar in their approach to actors. Now, obviously, Kubrick shoots many more takes of his actors, but what emotion they bring to in their real life, but he budges them into something else. The fact that Kim Novak in some ways was boring, and she was boring because the character of Judy was kind of boring. Hitchcock made Judy, this boring Kim Novak, into Madeline, this exquisite Kim Novak. And Kim Novak was the clay that Hitchcock was able to shape. And you look at like this Frenzy that I talked about. One of the reasons it wasn't popular, even though it's, I think, one of his best films of his 53, so that'd be 26 and a half, is John Finch. Play John Finch, who's he? Because it was shot in England, and he just wasn't known. But he was ideal for the character because the character was human but negative. Human, but there was a lot of him that was flawed, and he was terrific in the part. I'm not sure anybody could have been better. but he wasn't a named star. And so Hitchcock often saw in the actor something that would really fit him, his vision on the screen. And of course, there are the endless blondes, the Kim Novak, Marnie, all of the characters who are blonde, because there's something about the blonde that he feels in his films has an elegance that a redhead just doesn't have. I'm not fighting this fight. This is Hitchcock's fight.
He was very adept at seeing an actor's kind of hidden potential. And I'm thinking of primarily Perkins in Psycho. I mean, we've lived with this movie for well over 50 years now. We've had various sequels, you know, and Norman Bates has become kind of an industry unto himself. But take all that kind of crap away and just see the performance for what it is in that first film. That is a beautifully nuanced performance, and it's actually, and going on what you just said, I do find it one of his most kind of sexually perverse films.
Well, I think there's sexual perversity in most of them. I mean, there is sexuality is as dangerous and as corruptible as religion is, or as law enforcement is, that all of these human qualities and human institutions that come from the human qualities are rift with corrupt and decadent decay and abuse. And so it's hard for love to exist in the modern world, or in the world of either Kubrick or Hitchcock.
He was renowned for working within primarily, I guess, two genres, the thriller and the kind of the spy movie, the grand adventure spy film. In terms of the grand adventure, the North by Northwest, the Notorious, that kind of thing, where do you see his voice differing at all in those films from his films?
I really don't. I think they're better. They're his voice at its best. I think both of those films are wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Notorious. Sebastian loves the Ingrid Bergman character even more than Devlin, the Cary Grant character. So there's moral ambiguity. There's a sense of love that he sacrifices his life. The Claude Rains character, Sebastian, sacrifices his life so that she can escape. I think it's a really interesting portrait and study of love and duty. The other one, North by Northwest, it's got so much beneath the surface. But I see that this is an artist with the same vision, and you can pick out 10 of the same themes, 10 of the same instincts or ideas or qualities in all of his work, and it is in both of those films as well.
Well, at the base, I mean, North by Northwest, it's about a man wrongfully accused. It's just done in the service of an adventure instead of a thriller.
And it's also, but he doesn't exist. The character that they're after doesn't exist. He's a concoction by the CIA. So we've got reality and illusion, or delusion.
Not what I expected. A little taller. A little more polished than the others. Oh, I'm so glad you're pleased, Mr. Townsend. But I'm afraid just as obvious. And what the devil is all this about? Why was I brought here? Games? Must we? Not that I mind a slight case of abduction now and then, but I have tickets for the theater this evening. To a show I was looking forward to. And I get, well, kind of unreasonable about things like that.
With such expert play acting, you make this very room a theater. Ah, Leonard, have you met our distinguished guest?
He's a well-tailored one, isn't he?
My secretary is a great admirer of your methods, Mr. Kaplan. Elusiveness, however misguided...
Wait a minute. Wait. Did you call me Kaplan?
I know you're a man of many names, but I'm perfectly willing to accept your current choice.
Current choice? My name is Thornhill. Roger Thornhill. There's never been anything else.
Of course.
So obviously, your friends picked up the wrong package when they bundled me out here in the car.
Do sit down, Mr. Kaplan.
I told you, I'm not Kaplan, whoever he is.
Excuse me.
Yes?
The guests are here, dear.
Look after them. I'll be with you in a few minutes. Now, shall we get down to business?
I'm all for that.
Quite simply, I'd like you to tell me how much you know of our arrangements. Oh. And, of course, how you've come by this information. Naturally, I don't expect to get this for nothing.
Of course not.
Don't misunderstand me. I don't really expect you to fall in with this suggestion. But the least I can do is afford you the opportunity of surviving the evening.
What the devil is that supposed to mean?
Why don't you surprise me, Mr. Kaplan, and say yes?
I've already told you.
We know where you're headed for.
And I know where I'm headed. I'm heading for the Winter Garden Theater in New York, and I think I'd better get going.
And then at the end, when he's reaching for her, and also that the Leonard is about to stamp on his foot and gets shot, that is pure Deus Ex Machina. There's no way that hands save in that film. What saves is fate.
Mm.
9 out of 10 times, he would have stamped on him, and it would have fallen to their deaths. It would have been over. But fate this time comes in and spares them, and that goes all through Hitchcock's work. Hitchcock looked at religion as he looked at sexuality from so many different perspectives, personal and imaginary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's another prime example of his artistry, of his ultimate extraordinary artistry.
And the last question about Hitchcock, and because you feature a great interview with him in your book, you had correspondence with him. Tell me about that dynamic. I mean, what did you kind of respond to the man when you met him in person? What was that like?
A guy who worked for Universal, who was one of the promotion guys, set the interview up, and he told me after the interview that Hitchcock had given the thousands of interviews, and he said, "He said a couple of things to you that I've never heard him say before." I really like that. I mean, I was really rewarded by that.
Yeah. What setting did you meet him in? His office?
I met him on this. First of all, I saw a scene in the family plot. A friend of mine who interviewed him one time, another critic, said he was going to, Hitch was going to show him a freezer, and the guy was scared to walk into the freezer. He thought Hitchcock would shut the door. No, Hitchcock wouldn't shut the door. But it was at the studio. It was at Universal Studio, and of course he had his own building there because he was so bankable and he was so.
It's funny. Because he would play these kind of devious games with reporters that would talk to him. And I talked to Stephen Rebello, who wrote the book on the making of Psycho. I mean, it's one of the great making of books ever. And he said he got Hitchcock to participate in an interview for his college newspaper. He was in college, and he managed to snag Hitchcock.
Wow.
And he said he went to his office.
Who's he related to?
Exactly.
Who is he?
He was in the waiting room of his office, And he peered through the door. The door was open just enough so that he could see Hitchcock sitting in his chair getting a shave by a man with a straight razor. And just as the guy was approaching him with a straight razor, the door kind of closed.
A Hitchcock in effect.